This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Drew. That is audiblepodcast.com/Drew.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. A reminder before we get going with our guest that if you go to drdrew.com, click through on the Amazon link, doesn't cost you a thing, but helps keep winds in the sail of the Corolla pirate ship so we can continue giving you these podcasts. Also, the Adam and Drew Reunion Tour, Volume 1, highlights from three shows with Bakersfield, Santa Barbara, and Denver, something like that. We had a good time. Available through iTunes. Is it available on the site also, Chris?
Yes, it's available on AdamCarolla.com too.
AdamCarolla.com, DrDrew.com, as well as the swinging sound of the Dr. Drew Podcast. Again, that's just at DrDrew.com and iTunes?
Right.
All right, very good. All right, is my guest on the phone?
Calling her right now.
Calling her right now. Okay, my guest is Donna Rice Hughes. She is the president of Enough is Enough. She also is very involved in internet safety. She was Miss South Carolina World 1980. She has a bachelor's in science in biology from University of Southern Carolina. I've been noticing people are calling in about Jody Arias as well. This is not the Jody Arias topic tonight, but I will take some of that stuff if necessary. And I was trying to make a point the other night on my television show that got lost on people. Television is, although I dig into stuff as deep as I want to go here on podcasting, television is not a place where people get subtleties. Nancy Grace was going on and on about how Jody Arias was manipulating the system by claiming suicidality, ended up in the psych ward. I was, and then a couple of my attorney guests made the same point, and it kind of offended me because, listen, that's them theorizing that both the jail administration, the prison administrators, and the hospital in there are somehow flunkies falling for her bullshit. Listen, the Warren put her in lockdown in a locked suicide ward because she talked about wanting to die. And the warden called her out on that bullshit. If she is manipulating, the warden said, fine, you want to talk about suicide? Every time you do, you're going in here. Now, then it's a hospital. Hospital happens to be a different population than the average population you would serve. It's in a prison, but it's a hospital nonetheless. Hang on one second. What topic? The fact is it's a hospital in a prison facility, and as such, it's a hospital and it is regulated by the same licensing organizations and has the same professional standards as any other hospital. And to say that, oh, they were manipulated into this and to putting her in there and, oh, they're being duped by this. No, they're not being duped. They're doing their job. There's nothing more dangerous than a patient talking about suicide. That's the highest level of danger in mental health. That's it, other than somebody homicidal. They're doing their job. They'll do an assessment. If she needs to be there, it's because she needs to be there.
Yeah, standard procedure.
Some professionals have decided they need to, you know, she meets criteria to stay in a damn hospital. And it, by the way, if not, if it's just a manipulation or a grandstand, then the fact is, if it's just that she was manipulated her way into this and they fell for that, then a regulatory agency needs to get into that hospital and see what the problem is. Maybe their license needs to be revoked. That's all I'm saying. So I was very upset about that. I had to revisit that a couple times. And somehow, that don't have the time to explain that on television. Again, my guest is Donna Rice Hughes. Donna, are you there? Donna?
Yes.
Hey, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, you caught my attention when we did, I think we did CNN together a couple weeks back. Yes. And we were talking about the whole Steubenville situation. And that whole story got to me. And I don't remember what we were talking about, but I remember thinking, I got to get her in here. We got to talk more about this because the way men and women are treating each other, the things they're seeing on the internet, the way way our young people are being shaped is of grave concern to me, and it's not really being talked about systematically. So have at it. Where should we go with this topic?
Well, I mean, I completely agree with you, and it was really a great, you know, pleasure to actually be with you on that show and to be with you today. So thank you.
Pleasure.
I've been working on the issues of protecting kids in the digital world since 1994, which is really prior to, you know, the internet becoming commercialized, because we began to see the early beginnings of sexual predators and hardcore black marketed pornography surfacing, and we're very concerned that, you know, with criminals, you know, sometimes being the early adopters of technology and certainly young people, that those worlds would collide and our children would be impacted negatively. So that's how I got involved to begin with. So fast forward, yes, you're absolutely right. In my opinion, young people have been brought up on a steady diet of hardcore pornography. It's impacting them in negative ways.
Let's stop with that, because okay. I've wondered what that was going to, you know, it's impossible to keep that out, it seems like.
Well,
so it's hard. Yeah. Anyway, if not impossible, it's really hard to keep it completely out from young people. And if we had you know, a pod of primates and we expose them to super stimulating experiences, would we be surprised that their behavior was affected?
Well, you know, it's funny that you said that. We actually created this Internet Safety 101 program, and I'll talk later about that. But when you talked about primates, there was an example that I used, because I was talking about the power of media and even, you know, media like pornography and some of the really hardcore violent material that's out there that kids are exposed to at such early ages, and its impact on their acting out and imitating what they see. And I used a news story that I had found called panda porn. And there were these lazy panda bears, and they couldn't get them to mate in a zoo. So they created some panda porn for them, and the lazy male pandas just got right at it, and they didn't have a problem with extinction anymore.
So it's move past the primate kingdom into the bear.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Or the raccoon, I guess, technically, because into the large rodent category. But that shouldn't surprise us, right? I mean, that stimulating material stimulates changes in the brain, changes in our hormone
Absolutely.
Levels, changes in our behavior.
Everything.
Let's break down, you know, you said violent material online. Are you talking about video games, that sort of thing, or are you talking about violent porn?
Well, I'm talking more about violent pornography in this case, because I'm talking about pornography, but even violent games and those sorts of things as well. You know, I've testified before Congress one time after the Columbine shootings, and I was dealing with the internet side of things, and the other fellow was dealing with violent gaming, and he's a doctor, and he was just talking about the very technology that they use to train military to become killing machines, you know, from sensitive, caring people to be able to kill somebody. It's the same kind of technology that is often included in some of these violent video games. So, you know, I think that, you know, from our focus, we're trying to get adults, specifically parents, and those who are responsible for, you know, the stewardship of safeguarding, you know, their children and protecting their innocence and this kind of thing, to recognize some of the dangers with, you know, with this digital revolution that we're living in, and how to become equipped to make sure that their kids are protected, you know, using digital technology and the internet, so that they can, you know, benefit from all the wonderful upside of the technology, but be protected from the downside and the negative aspects of it.
So how do you do that?
Well, what we've done is we created actually a four-part film series with a workbook curriculum. We've been teaching and training parents, you know, for almost two decades now, in addition to all of our work in public policy and just public education. But what we found works the best is to, for instance, show parents how the pornographers, and I'll just take the pornography example, how they are deliberately tricking and using marketing, deceptive marketing tactics to get kids and just users in general to their websites. And then, you know, keep them there and then hopefully get them trapped, because they know if they get a young person, you know, engaged and going down that pathway, that they may have an ongoing consumer for life. And we do the same thing with predators. We have a whole segment on sexual predators and how do they operate? How do they disguise themselves? How do they gain the trust of innocent kids and good kids and smart kids, you know, and groom them to the state to where these kids will oftentimes voluntarily go off and meet them, knowing that they'll be engaging in, you know, sexual activity with an adult. We talk about, you know, social networking safety, online gaming, cyberbullying, all these issues to try to help the parents get their heads out of the sand and recognize that their child is not immune, and that the parents are the first line of defense, and get them motivated enough to take action. And the action that we've been, you know, promoting for all these years is that they have to use non-technical measures, which we call safety rules, and technical measures, which we call software tools, on every internet-enabled device that their kids use. So they really need to get proactive and recognize the government's not going to do it. Law enforcement is way behind the bad guys, and in some instances, they're not even enforcing the existing laws. Technology has taken the approach, the internet technology has taken the approach that everything is open access. It's not like radio, television, or print media, where you have some regulations in place. With internet, it's all open. So if you want to manage that complete open access, then it's got to be done at the user level, unless of course you live in China where they have censorship at the right, you know, at the national level. And so that's really been our approach, is to help parents just recognize, and teachers and law enforcement, and you know, we work with, you know, medical doctors and others, you know, because you never know who is going to be that trusted adult in a young person's life.
How do we deal with this? I don't disagree with anything you've said so far, but I'm very interested with what's already happened.
Yes.
And let me just toss into the mix here. I have concerns about social media, because what I see all the time, while yes, I understand that video game technologies are the same technologies that are used to train military personnel when they go overseas and become violent killers, by the same token, they don't come back here and keep killing people. None of
right.
them. So right. I don't know about that. But I see young people on social media acting out violently on each other, on real people. I mean, vile, violent, vituperous, horrible things they feel perfectly justified in doing to real people.
Right.
I worry that's going to desensitize people to the social space. But that's just sort of a statement.
No, I completely agree with what you just said.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that, but I mean, they're exposed in the military to, you know, to this technology, when in the hands of a child that is not having, you know, an adult help them, you know, work
process
through
it.
All
yeah,
of
we
this.
Don't know.
That
it sort of goes to the panda porn. We don't know the full effect. And
but we do know that the prefrontal cortex, as you know, is not fully developed.
Yes.
So there's a big impact. But I completely agree with you with what we're seeing on social media. And, you know, it's just, you know, it takes these horrible, tragic cases sometimes to even get the media
right.
to talk about it.
That's right. So
And that
was how we got together with the Steubenville. And that's kind of that's really where I'm interested, is where the horse is out of the barn, so to speak, where these males are already desensitized to their female human counterparts and their sense of their own sexuality and entitlements and all this stuff. What do we do with these the kids that are rampaging around? How do we understand this? How do we teach them? How do we reach them? How do we understand it? How do we make them understand it's a problem even?
I completely agree. And to tell you the truth, I mean, it's like, you know, the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Once the train's left the station, so to speak, like you said, it's so much harder to then bring them back and to sensitize them again.
Yeah.
And help them understand that, you know, sex isn't a commodity. Women are not objects. And to also remove this, you know, I think technology has removed this empathy barrier, or the empathy that we have, you know, used to have face to face. And And young people have gotten so used to saying and doing anything with that protective, you know, kind of screen in front of them, that is even lowered their sensitivity, you know.
I agree. I think that's right.
So that then when they see someone face-to-face, you know, it's just kind of, you know, it's just out there. In fact, kids don't even really see their online lives and selves as distinctly different from their offline.
Well, that's
why they've gotten blurred.
Yeah, I would like to break down Steubenville a little bit with you, because
okay.
I think that's exactly what happened there a bit. And we have a girl, a young child, who is intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
Already, that's a psychiatric problem for me.
Right.
You know what I mean? That deserves a mental health evaluation. If you have a minor sufficiently intoxicated that she can't care for her bodily needs or her propagation through space, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
That's a problem. That is something that needs referral, needs evaluation. Then if you add into that, that child is either being sexually provocative or being, you know, taken advantage of in some way, either way, whether she's initiating or not, still major, major problem. That is somebody who needs our compassion, empathy, care, immediate referrals. And when I went on television on the internet and said that, I was attacked for that. People went,
really?
Oh, you know, kids, you telling me that every floozy, that blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, when we go into a psychiatric, when a child's admitted to a psychiatric hospital, the evaluation the nurse first does is sexual acting out, drug use, truancy, law problems, interpersonal functioning, family stressors. I mean, these are the things but the sexual acting out and the substance use is at the top of the list. Those are signs of major mental health problems for young people, for adolescents. Why can't we grasp that as a society? And it's the adults that even first need to grasp it. And then secondly, raise our young males to go, uh-oh, this girl's sick. Let's get her some help, as opposed to we better have fun with this.
I know. And I wish I really had the answer. I think modeling this, you know, and, you know, fathers modeling how to treat a female.
Hold on a second. Well, fathers, they're not sticking around. What percentage of fathers are even around?
Well, that's my point. I mean, I think, you know, when you go back to how did young men learn how to act?
And by the way, if you really want to talk something like really get sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of wishful or extreme, and what might we even think about husbands? Oh my God, what would that mean?
Well, right. But you know, ideally, that's exactly the way it's supposed to work. You know, the young people, the girl and the boy, see their parent, the father, modeling love and care and intimacy and genuine affection, you know, for the wife, and then demonstrating this, you know, in front of the children. And showing that man, that young boy, how do you treat a girl? And showing the girl, I was just talking to my assistant about this today. I said, if, you know, the father needs to show the daughter, look, this is the way a man should treat you. And if a guy doesn't treat you this way, then run.
Right.
You know, but so many girls aren't getting that from their father. So, yes, you've got the breakdown of the family, the absence of fatherhood, and all these things in our society. And, you know, it's maddening. You know, I always say with our program, I said, look, I can't help a bad parent be a good parent, but I can take a good parent and turn them into a really fabulous cyber parent. You know, that's about as good as I can do at this point. And, you know, because we've got carnage everywhere. And, you know, and then you've got the girls, too, in this sex-saturated society that have become very aggressive at very young ages.
Right.
And they are, you know, sexting and tweeting and sending boys that they've liked, you know, topless shots and wanting to have sex at earlier and earlier ages.
Or at least be sexy. I don't know if they understand the full
implications. And to be sexy, because what does the culture say, Dr. Drew?
Yeah.
It says, hey, you are evaluated by the way you look.
Right, right, right.
Not what's in your heart, not how smart you are, but your look, you know. If you're not a certain size and a certain body shape, I call it the centerfold syndrome, even as you get older, you go, oh, my gosh, you know, what's wrong? What's
now,
wrong with
now
me?
Now, you were in the beauty pageant space for a long time, weren't you, yourself?
I wasn't in it for very long, but I was in it for a little while.
Did you like it? I hear mixed reviews from women that were involved.
It really wasn't my thing, but, you know, my mom kind of
right, that's always,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was really much more of an academic type and very athletic and sports-minded, but I thought, you know, hey, you know, this can help, you know, move something forward here. I had a modeling career. I started modeling when I was about 12.
So I want to ask you from the inside looking back out, did that have an impact? Did you worry you impacted on other people? Did that shape you in a way that you were looking back, wish you hadn't been exposed to, anything like that?
I wouldn't say so much the pageant business or the modeling business, but I can tell you that when I went to New York to compete as Miss South Carolina in the national version of the Miss World contest, I was shocked at the age of 22 how the predators came out of the woodwork.
Oh, how interesting.
I mean to tell you, you know, each young crop of models, wannabe actresses, you know, ballet, ballerinas, you know, I mean, they're just out everywhere and looking to exploit these young women. And boy, I tell you, I sure saw a lot of that. You know, but you're out of your home. You're out of your college at this point. You know, your parents.
Did many of the women go along with that? Do you think?
I think a lot of them do.
Well,
yeah.
I ask that because I think today that just heads on down the line to porn, right? Isn't that where that would go?
It certainly can.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly can. Oh, you want to be an actress? Oh, you want to be a model?
Here you
go.
Well,
you know, see, let's start here, and this is how you get ahead. And I'll never forget one guy who. You know, you hear the casting couch things, you know. He says, well, you know, I'm friends with this producer, and I gave him my headshot and my resume. And I said, thank you very much. And then he tried something. I said, I'm sorry. that's not why I'm here. He goes, Donna, do you really think you can get something for nothing? And I said, well, I actually did. Yes. I thought you were just trying to be a nice guy.
Right.
So, but, you know, but back to these young people, you know, the messaging that they're getting just in our culture is sending so many mixed messages, you know, about, you know, what's important, how do we treat each other, you know, just going back to the golden rule. I mean, you know, we say that in our program. I'm like, why do we even have to say that, you know?
Do you have kids?
Go ahead.
Do you have kids now?
I have two stepchildren.
Did you have concerns with them, or do you have concerns with your grandchildren?
I do have with the grandkids. These kids are on technology at such an early age. We first wrote age-based guidelines, I guess, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, and started at age 5. And now I say we've got to go back and start at age 2 and 3.
Ugh.
Because, you know, parents are letting their... you know, their 2 and 3 year olds go on their iPad, go look at videos on YouTube and this kind of thing, you know, for good stuff. But if they don't have some filtering turned on and parental controls, you know, just accidental access can happen all the time. And so, yeah, I am concerned, but fortunately in our family, our kids know, you know, what we're doing here at Enough is Enough, and so they're, you know.
How'd you get involved in this?
On top of it. Well, and it's interesting, in 92, whatever, I was, you know, just coming off, well, in 1987, surviving, you know, the big scandal of 87, and had really just wanted all that broken.
Hang on, I just was thinking, I wasn't even really associating you with that being the same Donna Rice, but as you were talking, I thought, oh, it's got to be you. Tell people what that scandal was. We were long enough, far enough out from it that I bet most people wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Well, if you're not at least, you know, 40 and over, you might not remember. But, 1987, my life really fell apart because I was associated with this, you know, scandal involving Gary Hart. And he
was a presidential candidate back then?
He was.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. And I was 29, and anyway, not to get into the details of that, except that the way the media reported it was not at all the reality.
Slow down, Donnie. You mean the media doesn't accurately report? I'm shocked.
No.
Can't believe that. I'm
and
stunned.
You know what was funny when you and I were on that show with Ashley Banfield, and she was talking, going back to that Steubenville case. She says, you know, well, gosh, Donna, back in 1987 when all this happened, and she showed a picture of me, which I didn't know because I wasn't watching the monitor. She said, but, you know, the news just reported it that night, and that was it. And I'm like, oh,
no.
Hold back. Yeah. This was in the on the front page of newscast and print, serious media for a year and a half, and until that election was over. But
as usual, women get blamed or vilified in some way. It becomes
definitely
your responsibility.
It's the woman's fault, and they're either kind of, you know, the Madonna or the whore. You know, there's like no gray in there. You know, and I really saw this firsthand. But the bottom line is I chose not to exploit my notoriety, walked away from blank checks and millions of dollars, some really good opportunities to do TV and media and have my own show. The head of CBS wanted me on TV, you know, to do acting or news or whatever, but yet ABC wanted to just buy my rights, you know, to my life story. And at some point I said, you know what, I can't even sort through this. I'm just going to say no to everything. And I went underground for about 7 years. I didn't know it would take that long, but it really did. And you understand this, I know, because you counsel people.
Yeah.
To have your whole life kind of fall apart in front of the whole world and have a stereotype replace who you are.
Yeah.
And people
you become
mind.
A cartoon character, almost a shibboleth.
A caricature.
Yeah. Okay. They like to throw darts at you. Know,
and I took it all very personally.
Ugh.
And
you were young too. You're a kid. You know, basically.
I was pretty young, and believe it or not, a bit naive about these kinds of things. And also at the time, there hadn't been anybody, a woman who had gone through any kind of a major scandal that had survived it and come out on the other side, positive, intact, and made a difference. And I, you know, my background, I was, you know, biology, pre-med student, graduated at the top of my class, and, you know, my reputation had always been very important to me, and then here it was destroyed, and I was like, you know what, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to take the money and run, which is what people advised me to do, because people, they said, no woman has ever survived this kind of thing, so you might as well just take the money, go buy yourself a nice island somewhere, and, you know, forget about it. And
oh,
I'm like, no,
God.
I am going to, you know,
terrible
Lord
advice,
willing,
by the way. Terrible
help
advice.
Me.
Horrible advice.
Horrible advice, but I knew better. And there was actually a man who had survived a very difficult time, Chuck Colson, and he was the only person that I could look to who had come out of a really nasty situation and scandal and come out on the other side to make a really positive difference.
What had happened to him?
Well, he was in the Nixon White House.
Ah.
He was considered Nixon's hatchet man, and he ended up starting Prison Fellowship and Prison Ministries, which he actually, you know, came to when he was in prison because he served prison time.
Wow.
But there wasn't a woman, and I said, you know what, by golly, you know, women do not have to sell their souls. They do not have to do kiss and tells. They don't have to go pose naked. They don't. And so I, you know, I returned to my faith. I've been brought up as a Christian, as a young person, and I'd gone prodigal. I call my 20s my prodigal 20s. Came back to my faith and said, God, I don't know how you're going to do this, but none of the PR experts can tell me, so I'm just going to take one step, in, you know, at a time and ask you to use all this for good. And so fast forward 7 years later, I met my then-to-be husband, and we got married, but he lived in Washington, and I wanted to be in television and film. Still, I had a production company. I was trying to get some TV projects off the ground, and he was here, and I said, how am I ever going to make a difference in Washington, because I'm a political leper, and I want nothing to do with the national media, and that's all it is in Washington.
Right.
And so anyway, I just came back here on a leap of faith and to plan a wedding, really, and to get engaged, and met a lady by the name of Dee Jepson, who was the president of Enough is Enough. And at the time, they were dealing with protecting children, women, and families from hardcore pornography, child pornography, and sexually oriented businesses because they believed that a lot of this led to sexual exploitation. So that's when I started, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I doing, you know? And within 2 weeks of starting the job in 94, someone showed us the early beginnings of sexual predators and hardcore pornographers and child pornographers using the bulletin board services and the news groups. And I said, okay, now I know I'm here because I've been a fan of the pre-internet. And I thought, okay, I've got a platform. The media have been calling me for years to talk. And I said, okay, we're going to take this thing public. And that's what we did.
And did Dee, have I heard of her? Her name sounds very familiar.
Dee Jepson, her husband was a senator, Roger Jepson from Iowa. Iowa. And so that might have been how. I mean, she's been retired for years now. But
maybe that's it.
Yeah.
And have you ever teamed up with the sexual addiction, sexual compulsion people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
We our focus is prevention, but we always say we can't catch everybody and we can't prevent, everyone from going down these paths. So we do refer to, anyone who has an understanding of sex addiction and treatment. In fact, in the film series that I actually produced and hosted that aired on PBS recently, I interviewed, some counselors in this area and because I think it's so important. I mean, we hear all the time about kids from really good, intact families getting, going down these really scary paths of sex addiction and porn addiction and girls, too. Mm-hmm. I interviewed 12 girls and boys, teenagers, who all shared with me how pornography had impacted their life, and the girls were telling me stuff that I didn't even use on air because I didn't want it to embarrass them later, when they grew up.
Sure.
And, they need help. Once you get all this stuff imprinted in your mind, or you've acted out, or you've hurt somebody, or you've, by the time you're 18 years old, you've had, 50 or more sexual partners.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the problem of bonding,
after
so many partners at such an early age,
they either develop or already have intimacy disorders.
Exactly.
Which are very common. I'm writing a book to that effect. Yeah, because it's not about the sexual stuff, but it's about what intimacy is and how it works, how it's supposed to work. We've lost track of that entirely in this country.
And
we don't even have a model for it. We don't understand the language of it. We don't understand what it's supposed to do, what it is, what it looks like.
So glad you're doing this.
Yeah. No, I think it's important.
There's a book that's been out of print for a long time, but I used to refer it a lot. It's called Rebonding. And I can't remember who wrote it now, but it was just so ahead of its time. But I think it was so ahead of its time it didn't really take.
Right.
But, about how bonding works and then how when all of this breakdown happens, how hard it is to then
It would be interesting to read it because we've now worked out the basic mechanisms and the neurobiology that's associated. It's all kind of worked out now. So it'd be interesting to see what they were sort of saying back then. And also, if I could, for listeners that are interested in this topic, the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health, SASH, they have a website, sash.net. Lots of resources in there if you think you have sexual addiction, sexual compulsions. There's screening instruments, there's referrals, there's reading, it's all in there. And I could see where your organization and they would sort of come together, you on the prevention side and they on the treatment side, obviously. But I don't think there's be much disagreement about it. That, I understand you're not trying to be, I hope, not trying to be moralistic and you're not trying to be overly legalistic or restricting freedoms. You're trying to be realistic and healthy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, but I will tell you, and I hope this doesn't sound moralistic, but one of the things that we do know is that, I'm talking about more about pornography, even though that's just a small part of what we do. The messages, are often sex without commitment, sex without intimacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not healthy.
It's
really, really simple. It's very easy. It's not healthy. We know that. That's good.
Yeah.
That's what my book's about. That here's why it's not healthy. I can show you in the brain scans why it's not healthy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that one of the there's an up and coming problem now with these young men who are having that or have sexual dysfunction,
yeah,
you know,
and
need Viagra and some of these other products.
Well, that's a whole complicated area for these young males because they have all these weird expectations of what they're supposed to be capable of physically, too. Forget emotionally.
Exactly.
The physical preoccupation. And here's what their female counterparts are experiencing. Ouch. And that's it. And they think they're providing some great, monumental, sort of elevating experience. No. This is like hurtful and painful and not what you're meant to do.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so funny you said that. This young man, Justin, that I interviewed in the film, I'll send you some of the clips, or actually the whole thing. You know, I said, are the girls in pornography like the girls you experience, when when you're having sex? He goes, no, ma'am. And he turned red and started blushing. And he says, they're nothing like, the girls in pornography. He said, the girls in pornography got something that makes want to do all this stuff. And so we have this conversation, and I've got him on film talking about it.
Interesting.
And he said, I thought I was doing something wrong.
Right. Right.
And
that's their model of what it's supposed to be like.
That is exactly. And we talked to the girls about the same thing. And one girl said, when they see things, they want to be like them. Like when a little girl watches Cinderella, when you're younger, you want to dress up like Cinderella.
Oh my God.
Like, girls were, we were wanting to be this way and to act this way because we thought that was the model of femininity and sexuality, but it wasn't,
I find it interesting, though, that you don't see any don't seem to have any ambivalence about modeling industry and acting and that kind of stuff sort of leading us down this path, because it kind of did start back there, right? I mean, or just would you think they're just entirely they're so quantitatively so different that they're actually qualitatively different, too?
Are you talking about in my experience or just in general?
Well, both. Because I mean, you were there in it, and you feel good about it, and you thought it was an okay thing, although there was weird predators around and stuff. But that's kind of where this all started, right, is in modeling and acting. No?
Well,
I'm being polemic intentionally just because I think people might think that. And so,
I really don't. I mean, I think you can be a serious model because it is a serious profession. But not go down those pathways. But now, of course, everything in even the modeling world, or so many things, especially in fashion and the Victoria's Secret kind of syndrome and everything else, it really has become so provocative.
But let me ask a question a different way, because I don't think you're quite getting, and I'm not being very
I'm
clear
not,
about
I'm
it.
I'm sorry.
Which is that, no, it's me. which is that you were involved in that industry at one time that has evolved into this thing. Let's just say Victoria's Secret. That's where it went. Are you ambivalent about that? Should we have pushed the horses back in the barn back there? Can we dial it back to that? Was that okay? Or would your parents have thought that was what you were doing was not okay? You know what I'm saying? Are we just a couple old people sitting here talking about just something that doesn't bother young people? I'm just sort of thinking out loud. Pornography, I think we all get, okay, too much. We get it. But even the way modeling and the way women – Gary says not too much. I have young men across the window from me saying, what are you talking about, pornography too much? But let's put that aside. But I got a bunch of perverts working for me here. That's all right. Actually, I've got healthy young men. It's interesting to kind of speculate, what healthy guys are doing with this and how they buffer against it. But that's a topic for a different time. Has sort of modeling and acting and film and whatnot has that gone too far too? And do you have any ambivalence about having been a part of the industry that started in an okay place, or did your mom think it was not an okay place even back then?
I think my mom thought it was fine. I mean, I did start doing bathing suit ads and things like that, but that was back when you do a TV commercial for Janssen bathing suits or something, but so I think that we were kind of okay with it then, but it's interesting. I just read an article by a girl who won Victoria's Secret's something Angel Award. And
I saw she felt like a piece of meat, she said, right?
Yeah, she said eventually she just got out of it because she said it wasn't really about modeling lingerie anymore. It was about trying to build this image of selling sex, and I really don't want to have my panties on, or no, I really don't, ready to take this bra off for you, kind of thing. And so I think kind of we've gone down that road. Now we're not one of those groups that gets all upset about the Victoria's Secret runway show, because I'm just a little more concerned about hardcore sex and group sex,
right,
and bestiality and child pornography.
Fair
and
enough.
Sex trafficking and yep, blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't have time to go there on that. But does it, you know, what takes a young person into this area of becoming turned on by things that can lead them down these roads? And sometimes, you know, gosh, back in the day, it could be, you know, lingerie ads in the Sears catalog, you know?
Right.
You know, or
no,
the Naked
right.
Pygmies in National Geographic.
No,
so,
that's, you've talked to Adam Carolla. That's what he used to use, the inflatable raft, pool raft box at the Big Five. That was his big thrill.
Oh, my goodness. But, yeah, but you know, so I think that we've all become so desensitized.
Yeah.
And, you know, even those of us, me and in the space, knowing what I know, have become desensitized.
Is it going to be up to women to turn this back? Because it is all about, it's a women's, I really see it as a sexism women's issue all the way through. Because men are just kind of going down, rolling down the hill. But,
yeah, I think, well, women certainly, you know, have led these kinds of movements and things in the past. But, you know, we've got a lot of concerned men. In fact, in the work that we do, and especially when you're dealing with the pornography side of things, not necessarily sexual predation and child sexual exploitation, which is a whole big part
yeah.
of what we deal with.
Yeah.
But a lot of these guys were very seriously addicted to pornography and have now become leaders in you know, in these issues, and said, look, you know, this happened to me, and this is where I went and where I ended up. And now, thank God, you know, I've gotten, you know,
recovered, yeah.
But it's a long, hard process because your brain gets rewired, and,
yes,
and you know this.
Yes.
And if we can start to teach our young people, look, when you start using this kind of material and then you're creating these new chemical pathways in your brain, and you decide, don't want to do this anymore, your brain doesn't take a whole lot for a stimulus to make it just go right down that path.
That's right.
Where connecting with a real person that you want to love, you need that image.
That's
you
right.
need that drug.
Yep.
You know,
no,
the drug right. of the new millennium.
No,
so,
I want to refer people to sash.net. If you don't know what Donna's talking about, that is all there. It's all been worked out, and she's absolutely right. That is the nature of the problem. Well, Donna, I've got to say goodbye, and I want to thank you so much for joining me. It really is an interesting topic and one I feel strongly about, and I knew you were up to something. I just, in the few minutes we spent on television, I thought, we got to talk more about this, see what's going on. So let me. I'm going to read through everything you've got going. I'm going to take a break in a minute, but before I do, I'm going to say that Donna Rice Hughes is the CEO and president of Enough is Enough, national, nonpartisan, secular, not-for-profit organization. The mission is making the internet safer for kids and families. She has a program, Internet Safety 101, to safeguard kids. It aired as a three-part television series on PBS. This is something that Donna executive produced. There's a website for this called Internet Safety 101. The 101 is the numbers, internetsafety101.org. She also has a newsletter. Did I miss anything?
No, but if we can, this is a program that we really want adults to get. You can use it individually or in a small group setting or even a large group setting. So you don't have to have somebody like me come out and teach internet safety to your PTA group or your church group. You can use this because we've got the top experts in the country dealing with all issues related to internet safety. And the bottom line is to implement safety, what we call safety measures, on every internet-enabled device that your kids are using.
Great. Donna Rice Hughes, thank you so much, Donna. I really do appreciate you joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, before we get to calls, I want to give a little love to our buddies at Audible.com. It is the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They have more than 100,000 downloadable titles, all types of literature, audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. And for our listeners, and by the way, not only is it New York Times bestsellers, it's, again, all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, even periodicals. And for our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook. That's right, just to try out their service. I'm a freak about this stuff, I got to tell you. I love these downloadable books. I do it all the time. And my own book is up there. An audiobook for you to consider is The Mirror Effect, a book I wrote and put out a couple years ago. And it's particularly, I think, relevant right now. There's some stuff going on, the way people are sort of chasing celebrities. And this whole Jodi Arias thing reminds me of some of the stuff I talked about in Mirror Effect. Mirror Effect for a free audiobook of your choice. It doesn't have to be the Mirror Effect. It doesn't have to be not Taco Bell material, though it could be. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Drew. That is audiblepodcast.com/Drew. And now let's get on to calls. Thank you again, Donna Rice Hughes, for having joined me. Let us get to these calls. This is Carol, line two. Carol.
Hi, Dr. Drew.
Hey, Carol.
Carol.
Hey, what's going on?
That's a hard call to follow.
Yeah, well, she was. I'm sorry to keep you guys waiting, but it's she was interesting. So, but please go right ahead.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Dr. Drew, first of all, thank you very much for taking my call. And it sounds like you don't have much time, but I do want to let you know that I'm a big fan. I do follow you on HLN.
Thanks, Carol.
And the main question that I have, Dr. Drew, is Carol is not my real name.
Okay, that's fine.
Because I have suffered from bulimia since I was 12 years old.
Yep.
I'm 54.
Mm-hmm.
The only times that I have possibly went to get some help was they tried to send me to a nutritionist,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't seem to help me at all.
That's not really treatment for bulimia.
Right. They have actually, it's affected my life in so many ways, and I feel like I'm a lost cause now that I'm at 54.
Have you had any medical consequences from it?
Well, to be honest with you, Dr. Drew, I've lost all my teeth.
Oof.
I've had some, medical issues.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, you're the only person besides my doctor that I've actually talked to about.
Okay. And does your doctor try to get you any kind of treatment at all?
No, this was back, before they even knew a name for it.
Wow.
Or I didn't even know a name for it.
How often are you purging?
Well, it used to be, maybe 6-7 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've got to, because socially, that kind of thing,
yeah.
It might be 2-3 times a day.
Okay,
but it's still one of those things that's never went away.
Yeah.
And I don't know, exactly why I started doing that, but it's just a great impulse.
Did you have any abuse growing up? That's a common sort of antecedent to this.
I was one of those back in the 50s. I was born out of wedlock.
Uh-huh.
I might have had some issues with that. It was a compared to today, that was a real shame to be brought up like that. So
uh-huh.
I think maybe it was some issues as far as that goes. I felt unworthy and I've been successful in my life.
Just having the abandoning father can be very impactful on young girls. I mean, forget the social circumstance. Just the dad leaving is big.
Right. And I thought about that, too. I've had, depression through the years. I wouldn't say, full-fledged depression, but, I do have some issues as far as, being self-confident.
Sure.
But I've pushed myself, and I've actually, done well.
But Carol, let me keep exploring the history part of this.
Sure.
The kids that were abandoned are a setup for predation. They get taken advantage of. Were you ever taken advantage of?
The only memory that I have, Dr. Drew, is I think my father, when I was like 13, he maybe might have touched me in a way that just didn't feel comfortable.
Okay.
It wasn't, anything full-blown,
okay,
but
well,
I just remember him touching me
yeah.
in ways that I didn't like.
Okay, that can get you going. That can be awful. Okay, so you had some stuff. And how was your relationship with your mom? How was she?
My mom was great.
Okay.
She did struggle, through the years.
I'm sure.
She had four of us.
Wow.
And, I was the child that was out of wedlock, so I had two brothers and a sister that didn't really relate to me. I think I was an embarrassment to them.
Oh, my God, how awful.
So, I just grew up, not feeling like I belonged anywhere.
Carol, here's sort of my, again, this is a sort of an inadequate, venue for a real evaluation, but just sort of brushing by. You sound terribly competent, remarkable person. It's amazing you have done what you've done and you've had no mood problems, but you kind of compartmentalize this little piece of yourself. It's like off here, my bulimia is over here, and it's still quite active. It's still kind of dangerous. So, it would be remiss of me to say anything other than why don't you see an expert in this and see if there's something they can kind of do to help you out a little bit. Why not?
Well, as I said, I did, back in the 80s.
No, not a nutritionist. an eating disorder specialist with a PhD or an MD after their name.
Right. I have thought about that. It's just one of those things I guess I've hid for so long, Dr. Drew, that, you know, hid from my family.
I get it.
I've been married.
I get it. It's always a lot of shame attached to it, and I really do appreciate you being open and honest about it, but it's a condition like any other. It's common. You were a trendsetter, though. You were at the leading edge of this epidemic of this, but it's so common, and there are people that are expert and skilled in helping with this. I mean, it is so – you have it so walled off and compartmentalized. I get that. You know, it's over here. We don't talk about it. Nobody knows about it. It's my little secret, and I've managed it for 40 years that way. And God bless you. Hats off to you that that's kind of worked and it's been okay, but – boy, I worry as you hit your 60s and 70s, the consequences medically are going to be profound.
That's what I was thinking too, Dr. Drew. And it took a lot of courage just to call you. For one thing, you know, it's easy to talk to someone over the phone as opposed to in person sometimes.
I get that.
I have great respect for you.
Well, that's very kind. But how about somebody who does this for a living? Somebody who sees bulimic patients as their bread and butter. It's what they like to take care of. They enjoy seeing in the Carols of the world and probably would be really interested in you because you've been doing this for so long. You're a fascinating case and would love to help you out.
You know, just because you said that, Dr. Drew, I think I may go and
all right.
try.
All right, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call me back in about a week and let me know what you feel about it and what you've done, okay?
Okay, I'll do that, Dr.
All right.
Drew.
Talk to you soon. All right, Carol.
Thank you.
Bye. This now is Nick. Nick, what's up? Nick? Whoops, didn't come up. Nick, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, Drew. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
Just a real brief accolade. I have been listening to you and Adam for a long, long time, and love both of you guys.
Thanks,
so,
Chicago.
I wanted to know about the addiction gene. I have chosen not to drink because of addiction in my family.
Yeah.
And now I'm wondering / worried because I'm expecting my first child later this year, and I'm wondering the chances of that passing on. My mother passed away from a codeine overdose. My uncle had his life ruined by alcoholism, and in no small part because of you and Loveline, I decided not to drink and not to mess with any of that stuff.
Cool. Let me ask your mom's ethnicity. What was her ethnic background biologically?
Ethnic. I mean, we're Caucasian, both of us. And
Scottish? Is she Irish?
It would have been French, like Swiss French on my grandma's side, which is her mom.
Yeah.
So.
And dad.
Her dad. Dad is
her dad.
English.
Her dad. Mom's
oh,
dad.
Her dad. I'm sorry. I wouldn't know,
okay.
Honestly.
Here's my great concern, is that the kid with the alcoholic gene from the alcoholic family isn't usually the one that skips using. It's usually the kid in the family that doesn't actually have the gene that goes, I can't ever touch this stuff. Not necessarily, but usually. But in either case, especially the case of the non-genetically predisposed kid, they will get attracted to people with the gene. They will marry people with the gene, that kind of thing. So I'd actually, if we were going to test somebody, I would test your wife. Do you think she has any proclivities?
No, she's a social drinker, and so
okay. And she and
she's
her
never had a problem.
Good. And so, her family?
Her family and her ethnicity is 100% Arab, so I don't know if that builds up because they abstain a little bit
okay.
more.
Okay, all right. So interesting. Interesting. There is not any real. There's an A1 allele test. I think you can get. I think you can get an alcohol screen over the counter from a cheek swab, but it's not a good test. So really, the only way to know is if you. And by the way, even if you or your wife have it, it's only about 50% per child that it gets through. Right.
Okay.
You know. So it's again another 50% reduction going forward. But my sense is you don't have it. I mean, I talked to a lot of alcoholic addicts. I can kind of tell when people have it. My sense is you don't. You could get that over-the-counter test to swab if it sort of reassures you. But I you know, it's one of them things. It's going to be whatever it's going to be anyway, right? And so
yeah, well, maybe, I guess that'd be my other question is would you advise abstaining? You know, obviously I can't control my kid their whole life, but would you advise abstaining or just,
well,
you know,
certainly until
I just don't want to get, try it and see type thing?
No. Get them, if you bet as much as you can, get them to wait till at least 18. That's the really an important part of it, is getting people to delay exposure. Because even if there is a genetic predisposition, the earlier the exposure, the more powerful the effect. And then you yourself, if you start to feel like you have momentum with substances, well, then you know, oh, geez, there's maybe a problem here. I got to be very, very careful with it. And then be even more diligent with advising your kids. Thank Nick very much. I got to keep moving here. I'm sorry. This is Andrew. Andrew?
Yeah, Dr. Drew, I'm here.
What's going on?
Hey, man. Big fan. Loved you on Howard this week.
Thanks.
Yeah, I just had a question about hang on. Sorry, I had to get off speaker there.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the drug Suboxone, because I was addicted to painkillers, and it seemed to be the only thing that could keep me off of them, and I still kind of feel like it's really the only thing, like, is knowing that I can't get high because I'm on Suboxone now.
Right.
Like, that's the main thing that's keeping me from going back to them.
Right.
So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, it sounds like you've had no treatment, which is unfortunate, right?
Well, I did. I did other things. Like, I've been seeing a therapist. I see a therapist every 2 weeks, and I see my psychiatrist. And I went to NA meetings. I went to AA meetings, but I really honestly, I just didn't respond that well to the NA meetings.
All right. I'm not a Suboxone fan. I don't use Suboxone in treatment, but like we had David Sheff in here the last episode, and last episode. And he was saying that Suboxone saved his son's life and that he's still on it. We don't use Suboxone to treat physicians, interestingly. We don't treat airline pilots with opiate addiction with Suboxone. I don't use it because I insist on abstinence and active participation in the program. But you're on it, and it's working, so stay on it. So follow your doctor's direction.
The only thing I worry about is that, like, eventually I know I have to come off. It's like a one-year plan I'm on, and I read on the internet and stuff. Because, like, I've read all about, like, the coming off of it. Like, I know it's not going to be pretty coming off of it.
It's awful. It's awful coming off of it, but you can stay on it longer than a year. You can, the fact is. I mean, if it's really, really working for you and there's no reason to come off, why not stay on it?
Yeah, I'm not on the high dosages.
Listen,
some people are.
Andrew, whatever. So. If you were actively involved in a program and wanted full sobriety, I'd say, man, you got to get off this. You don't want that. You're shaky, such as it is. You follow your doctor's direction. Just take their direction on this. Again, I'm not a fan of it, but in your case, you know, I don't see a huge downside to staying, particularly if you're tolerating it, not having a lot of symptoms, and you're not willing to do the work, and you're feeling rickety even on it. I would stay right put, but most importantly, follow your doctor's direction. I have to go. That concludes this program. Thank you to Donna Rice Hughes. Reminder to click through on the Amazon link at Dr. Drew.com and to check out the Swingin' Tunes of the Dr. Drew podcast and the DVD of the Adam and Drew reunion tour. I'll see you next time.
This is Corolla Digital.